Okay, good evening once again, sisters and brothers, and the friends who've just walked through the door. By the way, if I may just take a poll, how many of you actually saw the advertisement in the newspaper that we put up yesterday? Only a handful of you? Really? None of the rest of you seen the advert? How many of you saw the advert? Thank you. At least we know that's money well spent. How many of you saw the advert, and because of the advert, you're here? Okay, thank you. Well, we thought it was a worthwhile investment to reach out to people out there who may not know of the talks because you're not a member, or you're looking for answers in your life as to what we should be doing, given that we're always having to make choices one way or another. For those of us who are who've been members of the Buddhist Fellowship, be coming to regular talks, would know Ajahn Brown very well, and would have also heard about the Bhikkhuni ordination. I think many of you were here last night anyway. But just to give you an update, because I think that this email that I've got a copy of is rather disturbing, because it was sent to the Singapore Buddhist Lodge. It says, we understand that Ajahn Brahm will be a guest at your place and we have some important information that you'd be interested. The following files that due to Ajahn Brahm's recent secret Bhikkhuni ordination, so secret, on 22nd October, in which he did not inform any of Wat Phapong Sangha until the last moment, breaking and misrepresenting the acting head of the Sangha of Thailand, going against the head of Sangha Wat Phapong, resulting in a unanimous decision by Wat Phapong to revoke his status and monastery as the branch monastery of Wat Phapong. So this was sent to Singapore Buddhist Lodge. Of course, I think with the intent to disrupt the talks here. So I think for us in the Buddhist Fellowship, we find this very disturbing and very unmonkish, don't you think? Unbecoming of monks. We would have thought that these were the people who would be teaching and leading by example what forgiveness means, and that we have not just tolerance but understanding of diversity, because after all, wouldn't the Buddha himself have ordained female? Would he have today said no to women who want to ordain as nuns? And as I said yesterday, have these monks forgotten, if not for women who feed them, support them, organize talks and events involving them? And their mothers who gave birth to them and cooked for them? What happened? And do these monks forget that maybe next life they might not be reborn as a man? So, once again, this is a reminder to us that just because someone has shaved his head and put on robes, as what we have seen in Singapore, they're not necessarily practicing or even real monks. Which therefore makes us more grateful that we have a monk, a spiritual patron like Ajahn Brahm, who follows the Vinaya, who doesn't womanize or have, going outings with women. Even I have to talk to him in public, by the way. And who doesn't amass wealth, who doesn't do unmonkish things like driving expensive cars and spending on credit cards and living in condominiums and own houses and horses. It's amazing that, I think we forget what is really the meaning of being a monk sometimes. So please don't be misled at any time just because you see a man with a bald head and wears a dress. Especially when they're begging for money on the streets or doing really unmonkish things. And now that we've found a monk that we can consider exemplary and who has the courage and risk excommunication and being excommunicated and continue to walk tall and come and teach us, leading by example. Please help me welcome Ajahn Brahm. And if you support what he has done and the courage he's taken, please stand up and let's really show our support to what he has done so bravely for all of us. Thank you.
Please sit down. And just for a minute, just to say something about that letter. It's not all the monks in Wat Pa Phong. It's only one or two who's got very, very upset. And basically, it's not because of any secret. It's not because of lack of information. It's just because on the 22nd of October, we did do a bhikkhuni ordination over in Perth. And we did that because there was four women who had been practicing for a long, long time, who wanted to be bhikkhunis. And the Buddha ordained bhikkhunis, fully ordained nuns in the time of the Buddha, and it's possible to do it now. You may know that in Sri Lanka there are 2,000 bhikkhunis, so people tell me. But somehow in Thailand they think there's no bhikkhunis at all in the world. So, unfortunately, it's only a few people, but because a few people have stirred this up, I think really it's quite good because it brings things up to the surface and people can actually think about it and talk about it and see, according to our Vinaya, these are the monastic rules which were put down by the Buddha. It is possible. There's nothing wrong with the ordination. It has been done. It's legitimate. According to the rules of the Thai Sangha, we looked at those and we did actually check with one of the leading monks, is something called Mahathera Samakom in Thailand, a group of leading monks. And he was asked by one of our disciples, and he said, "You've done nothing wrong at all. It's actually not even breaking a Thai law, not a Sangha law, not a Vinaya law. But the thing what I'm doing, actually by doing this, the real reason is a problem there, because I've embarrassed many of those monks. Because for a long time they've been saying it's impossible, and we've shown it is possible. And because of that, they got very upset. But don't worry about this, because even the Buddha, people complained about him when he was alive. And one of the things which the Buddha said, no matter who you are, no matter how good you are, no matter how pure you are, there will be still some people who will complain about you and find fault. But really what we should do is just, keep cool, as they say in the West. Chill out. And all this thing will pass, because in the end, the people who are doing the good karma, the ones who have been keeping their rules and speaking in a beautiful, kind way and not getting angry at other people, and letting people come to the talks and listen to the Dhamma, those are the sorts of people who will eventually will grow and prosper. And those people are always negative, finding fault, trying to stop me giving talks. That's just a nasty thing to do. So it's bad karma. Bad karma comes around to people. So we don't need to do anything at all. I have a saying over in Australia. Now, Australia, remember, is a coarse country. And sometimes I have to use Australian words. So please excuse me. But whenever anything like that happens to you, there's no need to seek for revenge, because karma will get the bastards anyway, they say in Australia. So, I tried to get that on the calendar once, but she actually put it out because it doesn't fit in Singapore. But you get the message. So you don't need to get angry at anybody, no matter what a person has done. If they've done wrong things and made the wrong choices, that's their karma. As for me, it's interesting that, obviously doing something like this, I knew there might be some problems, but I made the choice. And I looked at that choice. I remember just the day before I was about to do that ordination, I gave a talk here in Buddhist Lodge the day before, and as I was travelling on the aircraft back to Perth, I still had a time to say, no, I'm not going to do this. But you know how I made the choice? I looked at I've already looked at the Vinaya, the monastic rules. I know it was allowable. I knew it was allowable by the Thai law. So all I needed to do is look in my heart. And this is what I often do. I look in my heart and say, is this a good thing to do? Is this the right thing to do? And all that journey back, you know, 4 hours, 4.5 hours from Singapore to Perth, I was contemplating that, meditating on it. And all the time, I always thought, this is a beautiful, wonderful thing to do. And really, it's actually giving an ordination ceremony. Now imagine if you give an ordination ceremony to a man, that's wonderful, good karma, it's a rejoicing. So why is it just so much fuss and bother about giving an ordination to a woman? I think that's even more rejoicing. So I looked in my heart, so it's a wonderful, beautiful, good act of karma which I'm doing. And therefore I made the choice. But when you make such choices, you have to be courageous. Because sometimes you make choices in life. And if you are weak and feel, oh, that something rotten's going to happen to me, no one's going to understand this, no one's going to like this, I'm going to upset other people, really, that's no reason for being weak and not standing your ground. Because in life, if people don't stand their ground and be courageous sometimes, then you know what happens in this world. Even now, next week we have the Copenhagen climate change. Even our politicians, our leaders, have to be courageous. If we always wait for somebody else to make these choices, the choices never get made. And even though the people in government might make those choices, and they may get criticized or even voted out in the next election, that's no reason to not be courageous. I'm not quite sure that those of you who have a big knowledge of history, but there was a war in Israel, and after that there was a, was it the Six-Day War in 1967 or 68 or something. And after that there was a lot of bad feeling between Egypt, Israel, Jordan and many other countries. And there was the then president of Egypt, who was President Sadat, just one day, without even consulting his other politicians or cabinet, he got in the plane and he flew to the capital of Israel, Tel Aviv. He just landed there with hardly any announcement and went to see the Israeli Prime Minister. He said, I'm going to make peace. And he did make peace. And that peace cost him his life. Later on he was assassinated for making that deal. But he probably knew it would cost him his life. But nevertheless, he had that courage, that fortitude to make a choice because he knew it was right, even though he would die for it. Now that's the sort of person who we find inspiring. That's a true leader. I always remember one of the sayings of Mahatma Gandhi, who said, I can see 1,000 reasons for giving my life for a just cause, but I can never see one reason for taking the life of another. Now that's the sort of person who you can be inspired by, which can actually change history and do something wonderful for this world. And those of you who see the course of history, whether it's religious history or secular history, political history, you know that every now and again someone stands up. They stand up to stand for what they feel is the right thing for people. And even though they may get criticized or go to jail or whatever, it's the right thing to do. I remember actually another of, I think this was Nelson Mandela's statement. He said, first of all, they ignore you. Then they laugh at you. Then they imprison you. Then you win. The four stages, he said. But anyway, I haven't been really in prison. But when you're making a choice in life, and whatever choice it is, this is why that the Buddha once said that if you are making choices in life, always consider four things. And this may be the heart of this evening's talk. The four things to consider when you're making choice. Make sure, number one, you're not acting out of selfish desire. Number two, you're not acting out of ill will, anger. Number three, you're not acting out of stupidity. And number four, make sure you're not acting out of fear. Those are called the four agati. Now you can see what happens when a person acts out of selfish desire. If I have acted out of selfish desire, what is in it for me? If I wanted an easy life, I would say, oh, you know, you women go and ordain yourself. But that's not a really nice thing to do, is it? But in selfish desire, people are always thinking about themselves. And if they start thinking about themselves, we'll never get anywhere in this world. So first of all, please don't think about yourself. It's the same with some of you men who are thinking having an affair with a mistress. You're doing it for yourself. It's selfish desire. For goodness sake, think about your family. Think about your kids, your parents, your friends. So don't just go and do this out of selfish desire. Because we do have responsibilities. We're connected to other people. Or whatever else you're doing in life, it's not, you know, as John F. Kennedy said, it's not what the country can do for you, what you can do for your country. It's actually a bit of selflessness. Sure, that part of life is for yourself, but a lot of life is for service. And if all you're thinking about is yourself in life, my goodness, you'll become very, very lonely. You will have no friends. And also, you'll die a very miserable death. All of religion, spirituality, all of morality and ethics is about being selfless. Not what's in it for me. Not what makes me more comfortable. If I was concerned about my own comfort, I wouldn't be coming to Singapore to talk again. There's nothing in it for me. So I said yesterday, look, all I get for giving this talk, we get like people like Tim Robbins. Someone said to me, they called me up and said, I've just seen you on the YouTube. He said, you're much better than Tim Robbins. The only difference is they don't pay you, but they give him about $10,000 for every talk. I think I need a new manager. No, I don't need a new manager. I'm very happy just with a glass of orange juice. But I don't do this for anything that's in it for me. And that's a wonderful thing that as a monk, I mean, you feed me. You give me my robes. You give me a place to stay at night. So you give me my life. And in return, I can give you whatever I can. I said this little story a few days ago. But you know, once I went to one of the, it was a Sri Lankan temple here in Singapore. And one of the first times I came to visit, and they took me around to some of the temples, and the head monk there said, would you mind signing the visitor's book? I said, yeah, I'll sign your visitor's book. But I picked up the wrong book. It was a donation book. And I'd already put my name down and signed it, and I went on to the next slide, how much are you going to give? And that was a big problem for me, because I didn't have anything. So I thought, how am I going to get out of this one? I'd already opened it, signed it, and now the amount I was going to give. So I thought for a moment, and I got my answer. I signed, how much am I going to give? And I wrote, my life. I gave my life. And that's a much better donation. That's actually true. I give my life to the Buddhism, so I just don't get anything out of this. Really, what I love doing most of all, and many of you have been over to Perth and you've seen where I live in a cave. And apparently someone has got a video of that cave, and they showed it at a little fellowship meeting. And you can even see the bat which lives in my cave. I've got a bat which lives in my cave, because apparently all caves have to have a bat. But my bat came from IKEA. It's a toy one. But that's where I live. And you know, I was so inspired by selflessness that one of the stories I have from Ajahn Chah, my teacher, and this was one of the inspiring stories. Sometimes people ask me, what was it like living with a man like that, with a monk like that? Was he enlightened? Like you asked me last night, am I enlightened? How would you know? If I said yes, you'd think, oh, Ajahn Brahm is just up himself. He's just so proud. Goes around telling everyone he's enlightened. If I said, okay, I'm not enlightened, you say, well, there, he's not enlightened. Why should we come and listen to him? So both ways you lose. That's why we never answer any questions. But you can actually tell. Well, number one, now, do you get angry when people criticize you? That's a very good test, but there's another test as well. And this is how I tested Ajahn Chah to see if he was enlightened. Because it's important, if you're going to make a choice, you know, who you can actually follow as a teacher, you know, what are you going to really take seriously? What's going to inspire you in life? And on this occasion, it was about a year before I was about to leave Thailand and go to Australia to start teaching. And I was sitting under his hut, he was talking to a few people, and out of the blue he looked at me and said, "Ajahn Brahm, would you go up to my room and get me something?" It was, I forget what it was, a robe or something. And I thought, wow. Because no one was allowed to go into his private quarters. Now, for the first time in about 8 years I've been living with him, I could actually go into his private quarters and see how this monk really lived. Now, by this time he was already very famous. Even the Queen of Thailand had visited him. Many generals had come to visit him. And they've given him huge amounts of donations and gifts and all sorts of things. He was a very famous monk. And I wonder, what would he have in his room? You know, would he have, you know, his bank accounts and a whole list of credit cards? Would he have these expensive mementos, you know, like pictures and gold things and stuff? And when I went into his room and opened the door, it was both a shock and also it was just so reassuring. It was one of those memories which I'll never forget. Because his room was empty. Hardly anything there. There was a grass mat on the floor, a wooden pillow, and one robe on the rack. And this was a monk who was so famous, people would give him anything. And what did he have? Hardly anything at all. That's how you know if someone is enlightened, by how selfless they are. Not how much they want, but how much they can give. And that's always the measure of a person. It's not what you need. It's not your requirements and demands, but how little you can do within life and how much of your heart and mind you can share with others. People always want. You know those sorts of people. They're really sort of terrible people to live with. Even when you're with them, you're wondering what they're going to ask for next. For those of you who've been with me, how many times have I asked for something? The only time I've ever asked for something usually is asked to go toilet, but I have to do that. So, you can know a person by their selfless. That's why when we make choices, see how selfless you can be. It's not what's in it for you. It's what you can give for other people. So that's why, like even this morning, having breakfast, you know, there was some toast there, but we soon ran out of toast. It was much nicer. I've got much more fun giving it to the kids. There's a few kids there. You know, even when I have little breakfast at my monastery, the cat always comes up. The cat comes up to get my milk. You know, I usually have some muesli and put some milk on top, but the cat gets it. And you know, I get much more fun giving it to the cat than drinking it myself. I make the choice. This is milk. It's for me. Cat gets heaps of milk. Cat doesn't need milk. What does a cat do? Just sleeps all day. And me, I teach. I need the energy. I've got to really meditate. I need it more than the cat. So I give it to the cat. Because it's just joy of being selfless. So when I make choices, if I think, what's in it for me? No. I think of what's in it for other people. And with that selflessness, those types of choices you make in life, that really is what we call good karma. It's right intention. Your intention is pure. It's not to amass things, but just to share things. And we all know there's so many resources in this world, so many resources even in Singapore. There's plenty of money, but it's just within a few people, and so it just cannot go around. There is lots of food, but some people go hungry. There's, you know, big mansions, but some people have to, you know, live out on the street in some countries. And we think, what's going on here? It's because people just do not know how to share. And their choices are, what's in it for me? What can I get? Rather than seeing how much we can share. When it's selfless, you find that we can get far, far, far more happiness in this life. I get far more happiness giving things to the cat than ever get giving to me. Much more happiness just serving than actually getting. So when you're making choices, not what's in it for you, but how you can serve. So if you're choosing a new job, don't just think how much money, more money I'm going to make. But come on, how much money do you already have? Is it enough? If you raise your salary by another 10,000, would that be enough? Another 100,000, would that be enough? I think I heard that Tiger Woods, who happens to be a Buddhist, if any of you want to play golf, it shows you, look, now the best golfer in the world is a Buddhist and a meditator. It's obvious why it works. He uses his psychic powers. He puts the ball, if it's actually going a bit that way, he uses his mind to bend it that way back again, so it goes in. So any of you really into golf, and I know how many Singapore people are into golf, meditate, get your psychic powers going, and then your handicap will go right down. But anyway, I heard he makes about, what was it, 20 million a year? Imagine making 20 million. If you made 20 million this year, you wouldn't want to work anymore. But him, he's going to be on the green next year, and the year after that, and the year after that. Poor fellow, he can never have a bit of peace and quiet. As for me, I retired when I was 23. And I've got plenty. So you can understand here, when you think it's what's in it for myself, you'll always be poor. When you share, you'll always be rich. This is the secret of wealth. So don't ever think in your job about how much money you're going to create and how much wealth you're going to give for your family. Because you might get more and more money, but what's the point when you can't be at home with your wife, with your kids, with your husband very much? Is that really how you want to live a life? As I said here before, there's no point in being the richest person in the cemetery. So yeah, okay, you make money, but please enjoy your life. Remember, it's not just for me, it's just how you can serve and how you can make a difference in this world. Because when you die, it's true, you all know that you know, all the wealth and all of the stuff which you've earned and your status, you don't take that with you when you die. What you do take with you when you die is your goodness, your kindness, your selflessness. And a part of my job, I do so many funeral services. I know nearly all the funeral directors in Perth. And actually, you know, this is no joke, many of them have seen, they've attended my funeral services, because that's their job, they're standing in the back to make sure everything happens. You know, several of those funeral directors have already booked me for their funeral because they say I'm the best. But one thing I've noticed at those funeral services, they've got something they call the eulogy, which is the people come up, and this is in the West, I don't know if they do this in Singapore now, they start telling about the life of that person. And no one ever mentions how wealthy they were, or how famous they were. They always remember them by how kind they were, and how generous they were, and how they were always there for us where we needed them. That's called a wealthy person, because when they make choices in life, it's never about selfish desire. It's always about how I can serve and how I can help. Now you'll find that it's hard work serving, but you will find, number one, you learn so much. You will be able to find the time, and you have a much greater happiness in life. At the end of your life, before you die, you'll start to think, what have I done with my life? How have I served? What have I achieved in life? And the greatest achievements is your social work, your kindness, your love, your generosity. That's what you'll remember when you die. So all of you who are thinking of having an affair, if you start thinking of that when you die, you know where you're going to go. You feel so bad about yourself. So don't do that. Don't be selfish. Don't go cheating on others. Because you have guilt, and it's very hard to forgive yourself if you're that type of person. So never make a choice out of selfishness. Never make a choice out of ill will. I'm going to do this to hurt somebody. I'm going to make sure that Ajahn Brahm never gives a talk in Singapore ever again. That's a stupid thing to do. Because when you make choices out of ill will, that is called bad karma. No, what is good karma? What is bad karma? Anything which is coming from kindness, selflessness, compassion, kindness, generosity, that's good karma. Anything which is ill will, hurting someone else, trying to even kill them or steal from them, that's bad karma. Look at this instance of bad karma, which I read about in a newspaper article. There was a man in the United States, he caught a mouse in his house. And it was one of these mouse traps which didn't kill the mouse. So there he was, had this mouse in a trap. What should I do with this mouse, said this guy. And as it was happening, he had a bonfire in his garden. He managed to get some leaves and twigs and he was burning them in the garden. And he thought, I know what I'll do with this mouse. I'll throw him in the bonfire and burn him alive. That's a really mean, bad thing to do. That's called ill will. That mice have feelings, they hurt. So he threw this poor mouse in a bonfire. You know what happened next? That mouse managed to run out of the bonfire. But his fur was singed and was hot. And as he ran out of the bonfire, he ran into the house and his fur brushed against the curtains. He ignited the curtains and burnt this man's house to the ground. And he said because he threw that mouse into the fire, he lost his whole house. Well, that's called instant karma. And it's true, it's true. Because it's all got, you know, these instant things these days. You know, people like fast food as instant karma as well. I don't know if you know this story, but this was some years ago when one of these people, they migrated from one of these very, very poor countries, you know, to Australia. And there's some of these poor countries, you know, especially war-torn countries like Afghanistan and Iraq, you know, it's just so basic there. Just in a sort of Singapore maybe 160, 70, 80 years ago. You know, the first time he went into a supermarket, he couldn't believe just how many things were on sale there. You know, he looked in there and there he saw like instant mashed potato. You know, just get this powder and you just add water and you get potatoes. So it's like instant noodles. And then he sort of went somewhere else and saw instant milk powder. You know, just milk powder, you just add water and you get milk. You know, he said where he came from you had to get a cow before you can get milk powder. What really surprised him, he went to another aisle of the supermarket and saw baby powder. And he thought, wow, these Westerners are very smart. Where I come from, you need to sort of be pregnant for 9 months before you get a baby. That's a joke. But we like it all instant, and sometimes karma is instant these days. So because of that, never do anything out of no ill will, out of anger. And sometimes we are mean to other people, aren't we? Someone has hurt you. What do? You try and hurt them back. Now that's very bad. You know why? Because you feel bad afterwards. You're in a very bad state of mind. And when you do something bad to them afterwards, then they do something bad back. And you usually get into so much trouble. You start to make wars that way. So look, if someone hurts you, that's their bad karma. You know it's their bad karma. No need to sort of take revenge. Just let karma, have some faith in karma. Even if you're not a Buddhist and you're a Christian, if someone hurts you, then God will sort it out. You know, leave it up to him rather than you sort of worry yourself about it. So no need to sort of ever seek revenge for things and have ill will. Because ill will just really makes you stressed out. And ill will creates so many physical problems in the body. Some people just, they start getting angry and they act out of anger, they make choices out of anger, and that just loses all their friends and wrecks their body. Everybody knows that anger stresses out your body, and it wears out very quickly. You know the oldest man in the world right now? You know who he is, according to the Guinness Book of Records? It's a monk in Phuket in Thailand. It's a monk, a Thai monk, 115 years of age. The Guinness Book of Records. It's obvious why he lasts so long. Because you don't have anger or ill will, so you don't stress yourself out. If something happens, oh, you no need to get angry back. One of my favorite stories is a Zen story. Now this is how you should deal with something, with an accusation which you never did. You're absolutely innocent and something happens to you. This was the story of the monk Hakuin, who was one of the famous Japanese Zen masters a long time ago. And this particular monk, he was just happily living in the mountain, just meditating and just going into the village for alms and helping the villagers and the townspeople, any sort of advice, you know, he gives them really good advice. But he's just such a peaceful, lovely monk. That's why he became famous later on in his life. But in this particular instance, there was a young girl in the village, maybe about 18 or 19, and she had a boyfriend. And the boyfriend talked her into sleeping with her. And she became pregnant. And of course, after a while, the father saw she was pregnant. And in those days, that was big trouble. And so the father confronted her. Who did this? Who was the man responsible for your pregnancy? Tell me! And, you know, she was a girl, she loved her boyfriend, and she didn't want to get him into trouble. So she couldn't blame him, so she thought, the monk did it. Oh, and the father was so upset, he called a meeting of the whole village. And they were so upset, this monk we've been looking after made my daughter pregnant, we're not going to stand for this, so they all went up the mountain. And they shouted at this monk and they cursed and they said, you're a terrible, rotten monk. You know what he did? All he said was, arsehole. And they were so upset. But he never had any ill will back. Even though he was totally innocent, he wouldn't give ill will back because why? That didn't help anything. So when the baby was born, the villagers met again and said, the monk is responsible, he has to look after it. So they all went up to see him again and gave him the baby girl. Here you are, monk, this is your karma, look after her. Now imagine, a monk. What does a monk know about looking after a baby? You know, sometimes in the Thai tradition, people offer me babies. It's like, you know, if they offer me a baby, it's like me being their godfather. So when they have a baby, they offer it to me, I hold it for a few minutes, and I give it back to them to look after. Because, you know, they say, it's, you know, I'm the godfather, but I say, you look after it, please. They're not going to get rid of it that easy. And actually, I usually try and get rid of it myself as soon as possible. I hold it for a second and give it away as fast as I can, in case it poos and leaves a smell on my robes. But anyhow, so they gave this baby to this monk, and what did the monk say? He didn't say, not give it to me, I don't know how to look after babies. All the monk said is, arso. So the monk looked after the baby. It's amazing what you can do, you know, with a bit of initiative. You know, a lot of times in my life, I've been put in situations I haven't got any clue about, but I managed to get by. Remember that time when I was interviewed by Shipping News? Didn't tell you that story. This was in a conference in Perth, which I was invited to. And after, during the conference, somebody interviewed me. They were a journalist in shipping. And they wanted to ask me, a Buddhist monk, about, you know, modern shipping strategies and the state of the shipping industry and the economics of doing this. And I mean, I'm up for anything. You ask me anything and I'll give an answer. It might not be right, but I'll give you one. But anyway, I answered these questions and I just forgot about it. And I saw him 3 months later. And 3 months later he came up to me and said, Ajahn Brahm, do you remember me? I was that journalist who interviewed you about shipping, and he said, you wouldn't believe how popular that article was. And I said, I don't believe it. He said, but it was popular. He called it Zen and the Art of Shipping by Ajahn Brahm, and it was syndicated in every major shipping magazine and journal in the whole world. And he got emails back from many experts saying, we've never heard about this Ajahn Brahm, but he certainly knows what he's talking about. And of course I didn't know what I was talking about, but I got away with it. But anyhow, there we go. He said, you know, he looked after the baby, but of course, like a mother, that's your baby. You know, you sort of pine after it after a few days, and the only way she could get it back was to confess who that scallywag boy from the village was, who'd already dumped her and ran off to the city. So she went to her father and said, it wasn't the monk. It wasn't him. I just said that because I didn't know who else. And I didn't want to blame that boy. You know, I thought I loved him, and I thought he loved me, but look at him. He's run away and dumped me. I want my baby back. So the father was just so embarrassed. He'd accused a monk of doing something he never did and dumped him with a baby. And he felt so bad he went and called all the villagers, and they went up to that mountain to say sorry. Oh, we've done a terrible rotten thing, monk, by blaming you for something you never did and by giving you a baby you know nothing about and how to look after it. We're terribly sorry. Please forgive us. You know what the monk said? Arso. And that's what I really liked about that story. When people criticize you and tell you things which, you know, you haven't done, or they mistreat you, or they sort of cheat on you in marriage, or they do terrible things, what can you do about it? You can't do anything. So, you know, when your wife said, you know, she's got a lover, just say, arso. If you can't do anything about it, you can then do something about it. One of the great stories which is in that book, which I always remember, and I keep this in mind all the time. It's about that story, again, back to that war between Israel and I don't know how many countries in 1967 or 68, the Six-Day War. During the middle of that war, there was an interview of one of the elder statesmen of UK. It was an ex-prime minister, and that was Harold Macmillan, for those old enough to remember him. And his newspaper interviewed this elder statesman and said, what do you think about the problem in the Middle East? And this guy, who just retired from being prime minister shortly before, without any hesitation said, there is no problem in the Middle East. And the journalist was stunned. What are you talking about? Don't you know there's a war going on as we speak in the Middle East? Oh, tanks are blowing each other up. People are shooting each other and killing and wounded. There's bystanders who are being destroyed, and their houses and villages are being brought to rubble. What do you mean there's no problem in the Middle East? There's a war going on. And this statesman said this amazingly wise statement, and I always remember this. I practice this. He said, a problem is something with a solution. There is no solution in the Middle East. Therefore, it can't be a problem. Now, that was a brilliant... It was right. Look, it's still going on. A problem is something with a solution. If there's no solution, it can't be a problem. Now, how many things do you worry about in life which you can't do anything about? It might be someone dying of cancer. There's nothing you can do about it. So don't worry about it. It's not a problem. Now, your husband might be seeing a mistress and you've tried. There's nothing you can do about it. It's not a problem. It's his problem, not yours. Some of your fellow monks might be telling all sorts of tall stories about you. I can't really change that, so it's not a problem for me. It's a problem for those monks over in Thailand, not for me. If there's something you can do about it, then it's a problem. If there's nothing you can do about it, it's not a problem. So that's that monk. He knew there was nothing he can do about that situation. So he had a choice of equanimity. Now that's one of the things, one of the strategies you should always bear in mind. It's not just making decisions. Sometimes you realize there's nothing you can do, so you leave it alone. And then you can wait for something to happen. And when there is something you can do, then you give it everything you've got. So some of these choices you have in life, you can't do anything, so leave it alone. One of the other famous stories, which is close to this, and I don't think I've told this for a long time, but it's in the book. But once upon a time, there's a man who was just walking through the jungle, and a tiger saw him. And the tiger was hungry. It hadn't had lunch yet. And he saw that man, and he said, "That's my lunch." And so the tiger started chasing the man. Now there's two things you can know about tigers. Tigers like eating men. And number two, they can run much faster than you can. So that guy was in big trouble. He was running and running for his life. And the tiger was catching up with him. And right before the tiger would catch him, he saw there was a well in the jungle. He decided he had no choice. He jumped into the well, thinking there'd be water in the bottom and he could actually escape the tiger that way. But as soon as he committed himself to jumping in, only then did he see that the well was dry. Worse than that, at the bottom of the well, he saw, yes, the big black snake. There's a big snake at the bottom of the well. So instinctively, he reached out to the side and he grabbed a tree root. And that tree root broke his fall. And when he came to his senses, he looked down. Because of the commotion, it woke up the snake. And the snake lifted up its head, opened its hood, and was trying to strike him on his feet. But his feet were just too high. The snake was trying to stretch to get the feet, but just couldn't reach. And then he looked up. The tiger hadn't given up on his dinner. The tiger was leaning over the well, trying to claw the man. But the man's hands were just too low. The tiger couldn't reach him. So he was safe for a few minutes, with the tiger above him and a snake below him. Then he thought, "What should I do?" And while he was thinking, he saw two mice come out from a hole in the well and start chewing his root, making it thinner and thinner and thinner. He realized he didn't have long to go. Before that root was so thin, it would not hold his weight and he would fall. But did he get worried? Why? There's nothing you can do. It's not a problem. But as it happened, that tiger, because he was trying to claw him, the backside of the tiger was rubbing against the tree, making it shake. And on that tree, just above the well, was a bee's nest. Now don't worry about the bees. It was the honey which started dripping down the well. And that man put his tongue out and tasted the honey. It was so delicious. And that was the end of the story. I love that ending because that's life, isn't it? Your life doesn't have any endings. Your life is actually a work in progress. That's why I love it. So the moral of that story is even if you've got a snake below you and you've got a tiger above you and the black and white mice, night and day, chewing at your precarious hold on life, safety, health, wealth, don't forget to enjoy the honey which is dripping down. That's delicious. Now that's a choice which you have. The choice not to worry. And a lot of you don't take that choice. And because you don't take the choice not to worry, you can't enjoy the honey of life.
Many of you young people, you may be doing examinations, or you've done the examination, you haven't got the results yet. Why worry about it? It's not a problem. You've already passed, you've already failed. It's not a problem, is it? You can't do anything about it. So, enjoy the honey. This is holidays. Have fun. So many of you may be one, but I must go back to that story of the tiger and the snake, because that's where the story ended, but I added my own ending. And this ending, you can read it in the book, this is plausible, it could happen, it's logical, and I was a scientist, so I like following things through logically. In my ending of the story, the tiger, he was leading in, he led a little bit too far, and fell into the well. Fortunately, he missed the man, but hit the snake on the head, crushed the snake, and broke its own neck. So then the two of them died. So the man could climb up at his leisure, and just having had a nice meal of honey, just walk away. Now, you may think that's a bit far-fetched, but that often happens in life. You know, when you don't worry about things, when you don't choose to worry, you just let go, it's not a problem. You'll find it's amazing just how things settle themselves. When we don't get involved, life tends to balance itself. Karma works its way out anyway. I've told this story for a long time now, and someone's managed to find the account actually on the internet. It was as many years ago, again in Jerusalem, doctors went on strike for 2 weeks. And the death rate plummeted in all the hospitals. It's true. And I heard that before, but someone's actually found the reference for me. That's amazing, isn't it? You think when the doctors are there, surely that not many people would die. But when the doctors stopped doing things, more people survived. Are there any doctors here? Now, obviously I'm not suggesting all the doctors should retire and become Buddhist monks. But there was something interesting in that. If you just leave things alone, a lot of times there's a natural balancing of life, a natural healing, a natural sort of the working out of karma, making things better. So a lot of times doing nothing is a good option for you. So don't always think, I've got a choice to make, I have to do something. If there's no real option, just sit there between the tiger and the snake and enjoy the honey. And wait for something to happen. It's amazing what can happen, because when you're making choices, if you worry, if you're afraid and think, I have to do something soon, that's when people get into trouble. The other similar story in the book, again, you won't find this in any other book, because this came from one of the teachers I was working with when I was a school teacher. You know, I was a school teacher before I became a monk. I was teaching teenagers in England in a high school, and I often tell them, many teachers actually understand what I'm saying, anyone who teaches teenagers in the West, it's such a hard job that everyone would think of becoming a monk. They don't have discipline like they have in Singapore. But anyhow, this elder, he was the head of English in this school, he told me, and this is one of his stories, he was a soldier in the British Army during the Second World War. And he was sent to Burma. Now, many British soldiers were in Burma during that Second World War. And he was on a patrol one day in the jungle, just with a captain and maybe 5 or 6 soldiers, just on patrol. And unfortunately, that day, they ran into a huge number of Japanese troops, a few hundred of them. And they had a scout, so the scout came back and told the captain that they were totally surrounded, heavily outnumbered, and the situation was desperate. And so he said, it was amazing, he never thought of himself as a hero, as a courageous person. But in that situation, he rose up to the occasion and said to the captain, let's fight our way out. There's not much chance that anyone will survive, but we're soldiers. If we don't try and fight, what sort of people are we? And who knows, maybe one of us might survive, and if we don't, we'll take many of those Japanese into death with us. Yeah, let's do that. No, just like, you know, those people in Hollywood. You know, who's that guy in Die Hard? That sort of stuff. Absolutely crazy stuff. But the captain who was in command of these 6 or 7 soldiers, said, no, we will not try and fight our way out. Instead, he said, we'll all sit down and have a cup of tea. It was the British Army, after all. They like their tea. But the very idea of having a cup of tea when you're surrounded by Japanese troops at war in the middle of the jungle, he thought his captain had gone absolutely crazy. But having a cup of tea at war, I mean, okay, if you're working for sort of the government, maybe you can take a tea break. But can you take a tea break in war? And he thought this is absolutely crazy. But orders are orders. He had to follow those orders. So they sat down and made a cup of tea. And he thought this was the maddest, craziest thing he'd ever done in his life. But what the heck, his life wasn't going to last much longer. And while they were making the tea, before they drank it, a scout came back, whispered in the captain's ear, and the captain said, put everything away quickly. The enemy has moved. There's a way through. And they all crawled silently through that gap in the encircling forces, which is why he could tell me the story. Everyone survived. There were no injuries. He said he owed his life to the wisdom of that captain. And his philosophy of life became, when you're surrounded by the enemy with no way out, it may be cancer, it may be your family is falling apart, there's no way out. It may be that, you know, you've lost all the money on the stock market. It may be you've been thrown out of your monastery. Well, what do? Sit down and have a glass of orange juice. When there's nothing to do, do nothing. Enjoy yourself. Because things are always changing. That's one thing you can be sure of in life, that things are always changing. So because they're changing, wait. Don't make a choice now. Wait until things change, until there's something you can do. And if you wait for the right moment, rather than making choices straight away, you've got this patience, the ability to wait for the time. Then when it is the right time, there is something you can do, then you can take that opportunity. And it's amazing how many times you'll be successful when you wait for the right time and the right opportunity. So when you're making choices, don't think I have to do it today. If there's nothing to do, sit down, have a cup of coffee, have a nice plate of noodles, whatever you like. But don't think you always have to do things. Then, if you don't make those choices so heedless, so quickly, you find there is something you can do, and you can do it selflessly without any ill will. But also, you know, with some wisdom as well, find out what's possible in life. Now, what your options are. I don't know how many people choose their partner in the first place because they look nice. Please remember the story, never marry a beautiful girl. You know why? Because if it's her beauty is all she needs to catch a man, she won't develop the other parts of her character. If it's an ugly girl, then to be attractive she has to be kind, a good cook, you know, charming, and sort of always very nice to you, a good manager of the house, Actually, ugly girls, you get much more happiness out of them. And you don't have to be jealous about them going with nobody else, because no one else will want them. And so you're having a wonderful time. Oh, you're great. So never marry a beautiful girl. And if any of you girls are too beautiful, don't go to the beauty parlor, go to the ugly parlor. And then you become more attractive to the guys. And the same with a guy, you know, girls, don't try and choose a guy who is rich. And if he's nice and rich, you know, he can afford another girl later on. So get one who's nice and poor. Who's got, you know, no sort of prospects in life. And then, you know, you can be much happier because you don't have to be jealous. You know, you can stick with him for life. But So when you make your choice, use a bit of wisdom sometimes. Look, if you're buying a car, if you buy a car, do you just buy a car by the paint job it has on the outside? You know, just because how shiny it looks on the outside? Of course not. You look at the engine to make sure it's got a good engine, it's been well maintained. So if you're going to sort of commit to a partnership, now look at the engine inside them first of all, not on the chassis. Chassis are very easy to fix up, but you know, the engine inside which they run, and that's the most important part. So that find out a person's character. You know, do some research first of all. So you know, ask their friends. Check them out. Hire a PI. Or whatever. But anyhow, at least you know what you're sort of committing to. And then, you know, you sort of, when you're going out together, well, sometimes it's very easy going out together at night time, isn't it? That's why I often say, and I've said here before, why is it that people go out looking for a partner in life at night time? Where are the romantic places in Singapore? In a candlelit dinner. Isn't that romantic? Having dinner with your loved one at candlelight. Or like a walk at night by the riverside, where it's nice and dark. Or like in a nightclub, again where it's nice and dark. You know why people fall in love in the dark? Because they can't really see what they're falling in love with. Don't do things like that. Fall in love in the middle of the day. Take them out in the middle of the sunshine, like today, and then really have a look at them. So if you make your choice with wisdom, not with stupidity. No wonder you get into trouble afterwards. Yeah, you marry them at night time, but you have to live with them through during the daytime, when you actually see what they're really like. So you make your choices. But one of the great things with making choices, don't be afraid of making choices. You know, when you actually find someone who's good enough, she'll do. He'll do. Because you never find the perfect partner. So you make a choice, but there are some people who won't choose until they find a totally perfect partner. Be careful about this, because your partner comes out, I'm perfect, aren't I? There's no such person who's perfect. And when we have to make the most perfect option, there's no such thing. So it's good enough. You can make it work, you know, if you've got a reasonably good choice. You've done your research. And once you've made that choice, it's not the end of the process, because then it's our job to make that choice work. Okay, we've got our car, maintain it well. We've chosen our career, make it work. It's like me choosing to be a monk. There are many types of monks. You know, good monks, bad monks, lazy monks, energetic monks, good meditators, bad meditators. But I chose, once I was a monk, if I'm going to be a monk, I'm going to be a good monk. So I put energy and effort into my life, into my career. And that's what you can do. So once you've made your choice, it's not the end. Make it work. And no matter what your career is in life, what path you take in life, you can't make other people work, because that's their job. But you certainly can make your life work, no matter what happens. So you make your choice, and make it work. And this is where we have things like generosity, kindness, selflessness, compassion, and it makes it work. So, but don't make choices out of stupidity. And some of the other big choices which we have to make in life, I just make these two points because I was asked it yesterday about an abortion. And the other time is about maybe your parent is on life support and it's your job to say, I turn it off or keep it going. Those are choices which you have to make. And I like telling you about these choices because there is a way you can make a wise choice. If it's, say, an abortion, number one, a monk, a priest, an imam, or anybody has not got any right to tell you what to do. These are all men who've never been pregnant. They just don't know what it's like.
So please don't be afraid of these authority figures. Number two, there it is, a being in your womb. Make sure you're not doing this, making this choice out of selfish desire. Not out of ill will. Not out of stupidity. You find out how much information you can about the condition of that little being, how they might survive or not survive, whether they will be cared for or not cared for. Make as much information as you possibly can. And lastly, and the most important, don't act out of fear. Whichever way you choose, as long as you're trying to do the best by everyone, it really is a kind decision, a wise decision, no ill will, no selfishness, it has to be a good decision, because you've done it the right way. And it's not a good decision because you decide one way or the other. It's not what the decision is, but how the decision was made makes it a good decision or a bad decision. So if you choose to terminate or you choose to continue on, that's not as important as how you came to that decision. This is what law of karma is. It's the motive behind things. It's why you do things, not so much what you do. Please remember that. And it's the same when somebody dies or dying. And it's your job to actually to tell that doctor, turn the machine off or keep it going. And of course, never act out of selfishness because you want the inheritance as soon as possible. Never act out of ill will because you can't stand going to that hospital day after day after day. Don't act out of stupidity. Find out what's going on. And please never act out of fear. If you really are coming from a kind, compassionate place, it's the way you make the decision that's important, not what the decision actually is. How it's made, not the decision to terminate or to keep going. And the way I do this usually, I ask people, if that is your mother, your father, your loved one, stand by their bedside and just make your mind as peaceful as possible and just ask. Ask the question, are you still there? Because sometimes, the stream of consciousness has already left the body. They've gone. They literally are just a machine. The body being kept going by another machine. There's no one left there. They've already died. But sometimes they're still inside. And you just gave me an article yesterday about a guy, I think it was in the Netherlands or Denmark somewhere, or Belgium, and they've been in a coma vegetative state for 23 years. And they were totally aware of everything which was going on around them. If that was your loved one, you'd know that. And I think the mother did know that. So if that's your choice, you stand by that bedside, make your mind as peaceful and calm as possible, and just ask, Mum, are you still there? And you'll know. I've done that many times. You can tell whether the person's there or they're not. You'll know that. So that means you don't have to. You can make a wise choice. One of those other ethical problems for Buddhists, that might be your pet, your cat or dog. And you take it to the vet. And the vet says, your dog has got cancer. I need to put it down to kill it. What do you do as a Buddhist? If you say no, the vet will say, you unkind, uncompassionate Buddhist. Because this dog is suffering. But if you say yes, you're killing your dog. So what should you do? And the vet answer is very easy. Ask your dog. And it works. So if that's the case, you take your dog aside, say to the vet, can I just have a few minutes alone with my dog? And look at that dog, hold it, and ask, have you had enough? Are you in that much pain you don't want to live any longer? Or do you want to keep going? And you'll be surprised how effective that is. If that's your dog or your cat, your pet, you will know straight away. There's a couple of people have told me how well this works. There was one disciple, her dog had cancer, took it to the vet, been taking it to the vet for a long time, and the vet said, look, it's time to put it down. It's dying, it's in pain. There's no possibility of it surviving. So she followed my advice, took it aside, looked in the dog's eyes, do you want to go? Have you had enough? And she knew very quickly, no, the dog didn't want to die. Took it back to the vet and said, no, I'm sorry, I'm taking the dog home.
And the vet was just so upset at her. Now, you cruel, heartless beast. That poor animal is suffering. But she took that scolding, took the dog home. And 6 months later, she took the dog back again, perfectly healthy. The dog made a full recovery. And the doctor was so surprised. You Buddhists are so wise and compassionate. And it works because you can feel the dog. So it's really not the decision you make, it's how you make the decision, whether it really is out of wisdom, out of compassion. So ask the questions. And then you can find the answers. If we never ask the question, how can we ever know what the answer is? So when you're making decisions like that, and it's maybe just a loved one, a pet, sort of a being in your womb or whatever, ask those questions. It's amazing just how much wisdom you will get. So there we go. I've gone far too long about sort of, you know, making choices in life, but hopefully I've given you some insight in how choices can be made. And also that sometimes, no, don't make the choice. If it's not the right time, leave it for a while. And then when the right choice comes along, you know it's the right choice. Remember the story between the tiger and the snake. Just wait for a little while, or just being surrounded by the enemy in the jungle. Just wait. There might be a time to do something, but if there's nothing to do, it's not a problem, okay? So if there's nothing to do, it's not a problem. You have a much happier, more successful life if you learn how to wait. We're just far too impatient. So thank you for listening. Very good. So now if we can have some questions, and especially from the fourth floor, which I was telling everybody, there's not so many people down there, so you can actually stretch out over there. That is the business class floor. This is economy, where you're all squashed together. So the first question. Thanks, Ajahn.
Thank you, Ajahn Brahm. First question. Dear Ajahn Brahm, I've been estranged from my brother for over 20 years. He forsaked me at a time when I was totally broke and my life was falling apart. I have tried to bury the pain over the years and crawled back to my feet. Recently, he suddenly declared to his children that we are one family. He has entered his 60s and suddenly became a very devout Buddhist. It actually opened up a can of worms, though, because all the hurt and pain I buried over the years suddenly resurfaced like it happened just yesterday. We still meet occasionally and on speaking terms, but I'm unable to remove the psychological wall that I've put up between us over the years to consider him again as my brother. What should I do?
Okay, it's important to try and take away that pain of the past. You do have a choice to carry that pain or to let it go. The pain of the past is like, carrying the pain of the past is like living in a prison whose cell door is open. You can let it go. So it's up to you to walk out of that prison cell of the pain of the past. Remember, if he's done some bad things, why allow the hurt which he has given to you to create more hurt inside of you? He's done a lot of bad things. Why allow that to stop you being peaceful and happy? So we let go of that hurt, that pain. It wasn't your fault, so let that one go. And actually you can look at him as a brother, because that's actually giving you some more peace and happiness in the future. You all know the two chicken farmer stories. You all know the two chicken farmer story? Okay, here we go again.
It's in the book.
That's not in the book.
I've got so many questions.
Okay, quickly. There were two chicken farmers. One chicken farmer got up early in the morning, went into the chicken shed to collect the produce of the night before, took his basket into the chicken shed and filled the basket full of chicken shit. And he left the eggs in the shed to rot. He took the shit back in the house where it stank the whole house out. He was a very stupid chicken farmer. Chicken farmer number two went into the shed. He left the shit to rot because it would be valuable fertilizer later on, but you don't take it into the house with you. He filled the basket full of eggs and brought the eggs back into the house. And then he could make an omelette for his family and sell the rest of the eggs in the market for cash. He was a very smart chicken farmer. The meaning of that story is this. When you remember your past, what do you put in the basket and bring into the present with you? The eggs or the shit? Are you a shit collector or an egg collector? Now, you remember the pain of the past, it means you're a shit collector. Let that rot in the past. Doesn't matter what your brother did. Let that rot in the past. And take the beautiful memories into the future with you. You can do that. And that's wise. Thank you.
And that story is in Ajahn Brown's book, Opening the Door of Your Heart.
No, it's not. No. It's not in that one. No. Totally new story. That's why I told it again.
All right.
I've caught you out. You haven't read that book. A long time ago.
Of course I have. What would you advise a person experiencing culture shock in a foreign land?
Oh, culture shock in a foreign land. I suffered culture shock. I was an English guy, a Londoner, and I went to Thailand. And I asked, where's the toilet? And they said, in that room. And I couldn't see any place to sit down in there. There's squat toilets. And I went, they gave me some oranges, but they were green. I thought you couldn't eat them, but they were Asian oranges. I had so much culture shock. So, have fun with it. You get lots and lots of stories to tell to people. So, one thing with culture shock, it does actually make you see things from a totally different angle. Well, that's one of the greatest things. 8 years, 8.5 years in Thailand, I had to see things, you know, from a Thai point of view. And I realized there's many more ways of looking at life than just one point of view. Different cultures, if you can put them together, they give you a much wiser view. So culture shock is just growing pain. So you're learning something. So, you know, keep the pain going, you're going to grow somewhere. Okay, you ready yet, or should I carry on?
Yes, I'm ready. Ajahn Brahm, we have evolved into a complex being, having a complex mind, complex living, complex concepts. To attain enlightenment, we have to be simple. Why is this so? Can we just be created simple?
Created simple? No, come on, you grow simple. Like me, since I had so much complexity, we just make it more simple. So you just have, you know, one robe to wear. It's much better because you don't have to choose what you're going to wear when you get up in the morning. You don't have to worry about fashion. I've seen all these shops in Singapore. Amazing how many different sort of clothes you can wear. And just in the place where I've been staying the last days, next house to me, or next room to me, they've got all these shoes outside. I can't imagine how many more people must be living in that house. So keep it simple. And it's much. You're not born a complex person. Look at a baby. Are the baby complex? They're very simple. So the trouble is we grow to be complex. And so you can actually grow the other way. Keep it simple. Just one wife is enough. Keep it simple.
Okay, here comes the complex part.
Okay, go on.
My husband's having an affair with his co-worker. Oh. How many of you are having husbands with husbands having an affair with co-worker? Okay, we have a 4-year-old daughter and a 2-year-old boy. He has served me separation papers last week, but it's not moving out of the house. It kills me to see him every day, and I want to divorce him, but I hope he'll come to his senses and come home to us, because the other woman actually has another man, and my husband knows.
Yeah.
I really hope he realizes his folly and not break up our family just to be with her, da-da-da. Okay, what do I do?
Some people are very, very stupid. And it really does hurt other people. So I'm not quite sure what you can do about that man. Again, sometimes that you can't solve the problem yourself. You've got to go the roundabout route with his parents or with his friends or something or other to knock some sense into him. But certainly that, you know, it's no right to stay in the same house with you if he's acting like that. But obviously that sometimes you made a wrong choice in life by choosing a man like that. You know, there are some people who are just, they are selfish, and they go around hurting others. So my advice would be just to call it quits and get him out of the house. It hurts, but it's much better to get that tooth out, the rotten tooth out, so that you can actually have a healthy mouth for the future. So that's what I say, because anyone who's cheating you like that is actually so stupid. Of course, the person may think that that's the love of his life, and he's doing the right thing. It always feels right at the time when you really have a lot of lust. Lust is like crazy. That's why I say I'm crazy in love. You're not seeing things correctly. So be careful, because you can see in so many places in life, people have had that lust, and they followed that lust, and they catch so much pain for themselves and others, and they regret it enormously afterwards.
So that fellow's got too sick with the cancer of infidelity, which hurts much more than any other cancer. But make sure any guys here, girls here, it goes both ways, make sure you don't do that. You create so much pain in life. What are you doing that for?
Similar question. My marriage of 6 months has broken down. My husband's chosen to abandon our marriage so that he can marry the prostitute he had sex with. Every day is an emotional roller coaster for me. Can you please give me some advice? And I love the podcast.
Yeah.
And help me through the darkest moments. Thank you.
Well, have some compassion for that poor prostitute who's going to have to put up with him.
Oh, sorry. Thank
you. Go on.
In certain faiths, they pray in order to make connections and talk their hearts out. How do we do it in Buddhism? How can we talk to the Buddha? Like Westerners talk to God.
Okay. Sometimes people talk to God, but he's not listening. So it's exactly the same, but there's one difference. Talking to God and talking to the Buddha, at least you can see the Buddha.
Are you done?
Yeah. Yeah, okay, yeah.
Dear Ajahn Brahm, how do you solve the problem of indecision? I find it very hard to make decisions.
A lot of times people find it hard to make decisions because they're too afraid to make decisions. So look, you know, sometimes, you know, if I did have a coin, I'd just flip it up. Well, what should I talk on tonight? So, but for me in my life, I've always found it easy to make decisions because I find out there's no such thing as a right decision or a wrong decision. I think did I tell that story about the king who cut his finger? Oh, here, this is a good story. Actually, they're all good stories.
And it's not in the book.
It's not in the book, very good. Once upon a time, there was a king going out hunting. And as he was going out hunting, he cut his finger and had a doctor with him at all times. So the doctor looked at his finger, said, oh, that'll be okay. No, he actually didn't say it was okay. The king asked, is it going to be okay? And the doctor bandaged it and said, good or bad, who knows? A couple of days later, back at the palace, the finger was infected. So the king said, look at my finger, it's getting worse. And so the doctor looked at it and put some ointment on it, bandaged it up again. Is it going to be okay? And the doctor said, good or bad, who knows? A few days later, it was so bad, he had to amputate it. And the king said, what do you mean, good or bad? Who knows? It's bad. You're a bad doctor, and I'm going to tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to put you in jail. So he threw the doctor in jail. Now, doctor, is that good or bad? And the doctor said, good or bad, who knows? Ah, that crazy guy, said the king. And a few days later, when the wound had, was good enough, he went out hunting again. But this time, he got lost in the forest, and he got captured by the forest people. And they took him to their big god in the middle of the jungle to sacrifice him. And they're just about to sacrifice him, and they noticed there was one finger missing. So he said he wasn't perfect enough, so they let him go free. And he said, wow, that doctor was so wise. And so he went back to the jail, and he freed the doctor. He said, look, you said good or bad, who knows? I thought it was terribly bad, but because I lost my finger, you saved my life. That was a good thing you did. It was a bad thing I did, put you in jail. A bad thing you did, said the doctor. Look, if you hadn't put me in jail, I'd have been with you. I've got all my fingers. I'd been sacrificed. So just make a decision, good or bad, who knows?
Okay, here's a mother-in-law question.
Okay.
How do you have problems with mother-in-laws? Raise your hand.
Nah, gotta be careful, mother-in-law might be here watching.
On my wedding day, my groom was supposed to transfer his loyalty from his parents to me. Thank you. In other words, my needs should become priority over his mother's needs. The main reason that I don't get along well with this Hitler woman is because we feel the constant need to compete with each other for the affectionate attention of the same man. Both my mother-in-law and I are probably contributing to the problem, and my husband is actually the one whose behavior plays the role. What is your advice?
Okay, look, just leave it all alone and become a nun. It's much easier.
No, okay, you can work with it. Remember what I said yesterday, look at your mother-in-law, especially if you're like a Mahayana Buddhist, and look like Kuan Yin with the face of your mother-in-law. Or if you're a Theravada Buddhist, now look at her like sort of like a Buddha, but you know, your mother-in-law's face. And then you actually regard her in a different way. And then, okay, then if you regard people in a very compassionate, kind way, it changes the whole relationship. So it's something which you can do. And actually look at her with compassion rather than with competing. Go on.
The bhikkhuni ordination has caused a lot of disharmony in the Sangha in Thailand, even in your own monastery. Why did you ordain the bhikkhunis when all the elders object? If the ordination was a good idea, why did you have to keep it a secret?
Very good. You could
have done it a different way, like returning from Wat Pa Pong beforehand, would you have changed your approach?
Okay, first of all, there's total harmony in my monastery in Perth, and all of the people in Western Australia. We're just talking with the president, Dennis Shepherd. He hasn't got one negative comment about the bhikkhuni ordination. Everybody is totally behind it. And again, hopefully you've signed that I petition on the internet now. There's an I petition supporting bhikkhuni ordination with people like Richard Gere. He signed it. And Bernie Glassman, he's a famous Buddhist musician in the United States. And Robert Thurman, that's Uma Thurman's father. So many people have signed that. So one of the reasons I did it, I made a choice. And it seemed the appropriate thing to do. I'd already actually understood that the monks in Thailand, it's proved right from their reaction, there's no way they would actually give me permission to do that. If you actually asked them, pretty sure, you know, that they would say no. Basically, it was a waste of time. When it was a foregone conclusion, they would say no. And even, unfortunately, that many of the other Western senior monks, I'd already found out they'd made a stand against that. And because I knew what the answer would be, it wasn't really much point asking it. So we just did it. And we don't do those things to create disharmony. We do those things, the intention is not to create a problem for anybody. The intention was to give the opportunity for women to become equal in Buddhism.
Thank you. In fact, the debate on bhikkhuni ordination has been going for years, and there has never been consensus. So it's either you do it, or you never get it done. So, your emptiness, Ajahn Brahm. You made a choice to criticize the Dalai Lama because of his wrong views. I now criticize you for choosing scientific studies to back up your teachings when they accord with them, and brushing aside those that do not and unscientifically choose a sample size of one, i.e. you, yesterday, to say that it was rubbish. That sort of thing you said the scientific community would do to one another when one discovered something or other did not. At least you could do as a scientist is to say you'll try to read the details of the study first and not to bend the facts to suit the faith.
Okay, that's a very good quote. And again, it's very good to be able to criticize a monk. So please, that no monk is beyond criticism. So please criticize. I think the question yesterday, there was some study, which I haven't seen. There's too many studies to read them all. And the study was saying something like that if you are mean or negative, you actually become wiser and you see deeper into things and you get more things done in life, I remember correctly. And again, that it doesn't really make sense to me. That type of science, and I must say, as a scientist, we call that soft science. Because that science was taking a huge sample and actually trying to find some tendencies, you know, in that huge sample. And actually to prove that you're more effective, to prove that that negativity works, that's such a hard thing to prove. There's so many variables, it's almost really impossible to prove. So actually, as a scientist, I doubt just even the scientific procedures of doing things like that. You have to be very, very careful. When I criticized the Dalai Lama, I criticized him for one thing, which when he said, it was reported, I think, in the Daily Telegraph, he said a gay person can't be a Buddhist. And when I heard that, I said, look, that's wrong. He's retracted that.
sins. And I said, that's wrong, because that's against the teachings of the Buddha, against compassion. There's nothing in the suttas, nothing in the teaching of the Buddha to say that. So actually I wrote to our local paper, because many of the people I knew in Perth, they complained. They said, is that really true, that as a gay you can't be a Buddhist? And I said, no, it's not true. So instead of just saying that, I had to write it in the newspaper. So again, remember that science, there is hard science and there is soft science. So especially when you get like tendencies like that, when you're trying to sort of see that negativity, is that going to really make a more effective world? I really just deep down can't understand that. And I'd really like to look at the study. Whoever said that, please present me with the study and have a look at it for you. But anyway, but thank you for criticizing me.
Keeps him straight. My father passed away in a car accident, so I have to give up my job to look after his business, where I don't have any experience, and the business has been doing very badly. I don't know whether to give up my job or to continue his business. What's the right choice?
Well, again, you've made that choice already. So number one, don't look backwards and think, what should I have done? Because every time you look backwards, what should you have done? Number one, you don't know how it worked out. If you had kept your business and not looked after your father's business, you don't know what might have happened. So because of that, never look back and think, what if? You just can't know what would have happened if you'd gone through another path in life. So number two, this is where you are right now. You know, you're with your father's business, you've given up your job, it's not doing well. Get some help. Get some advice. There's other people who can actually maybe help you, make sure you get that business going. And maybe it's just you're learning the ropes of it. It may not work now, but maybe later on it will do well. But certainly what I can advise is don't ever look back and say, what if?
I've been working my family business for the past 18 months and it's been very frustrating for me as I can't seem to work well with my mother. See, even sons have problems with their own mothers. So. And we have endless arguments and I'm really keen to continue helping out my family business. But how can I keep peace with my mother while retaining my sanity?
Okay. Well, get a secretary and get the secretary to be your liaison with your mother so you don't have to see her. Now, it's very difficult because if you're in a business, you know, the relationships you have in a business between your, you know, partners or between, you know, your managers and your staff is much different than the relationship you have to have with people in your family. So that's why sometimes family businesses can be difficult if you don't have, you know, proper separation of roles. So be very careful there. And remember, you know, in your business, that's not your mother. That might be your boss or maybe your tea lady. I don't know what she does in the office. But it's not your mother when it's in business. Because then you can have a much clearer, like, separation of roles. Does that make sense, businesswoman?
Yes.
I don't know why you ask me these questions, because I don't know business. Go on.
Today I made my choice to be in the business class on the fourth floor.
Very good.
My question is, my company has a new team of management and they seem to pick on me in everything I do. I'm angry and worried. Hope this is a problem that I have a solution to.
All right, if they keep picking on you, it must mean that they're looking at training you for the next advancement. They must be sort of testing you out, you know, they've noticed you, which is... I don't know why they're picking on you, but maybe just you know, find out. Maybe give them some compassion and kindness. Next time you see them, just smile at them. And they think, what does he know that I don't know?
Maybe it's time to move on.
Oh, time to move on, yeah.
This person here has asked for my email address. You can just send your CVs to Buddhist Fellowship and they will forward it to me. Dear Ajahn Brahm, I've been married for 5 years with 2 children. I love my wife and children dearly. 3 years ago, I resigned from my salary job, a low-paying salary job, to join my father's disco club. During these 3 years, I managed to buy a car and a house, but neglected my wife and children. Now she's left me and brought the 2 children with her. I've tried all ways to win her back, but to no avail. My wife wants me to totally stop working for my father, who is a triad leader and womanizer, as she feels that he is a bad influence. So if I choose to follow my wife's wish, I will have no means to pay my bank loans and thus will become a bankrupt. I'm emotionally drained, as what should I do?
Okay, if you're going to choose the love for your family over your financial security, now to me I'd always choose love for my family. And again, you can always change that job for a job with Angie Co. You've got lots of people coming up. But you can always find another job. I think the economy is growing in Singapore. Is that the case?
Yeah, we have 70 vacancies in my company. So
there we go.
You can always come and talk to me.
And it's not a disco company, is it?
No. There are lots and lots of jobs out there. You just have to find the right one.
Choose your family. I'm sure you can get out of losing all your money and home and stuff.
My mother passed away 2 months ago. Her body was resting at home for only about an hour, and she was taken away by Singapore Casket, which is an undertaker. My friends told me that I should have left the body at home for at least 4 hours before sending it away. Up until today, I feel very regretful and upset on my wrong choice. I was told not to do any renovations for at least 100 days, as it will affect the soul of the deceased. Is that true?
No, absolutely wrong. I've got that on greatest authority of other ghosts and other beings. No, you don't need an hour, half an hour, a few minutes is long enough to sort of dispose of the body. There's nothing wrong with doing that at all. That is just superstition to say you have to leave it for 4 hours or more. Usually when the person dies, at that very moment, usually the stream of consciousness leaves the body. If you really want to have evidence about that, look at the work of Pim van Lommel. Just get into Google and put in the words NDEs, and you get all this information about people who can remember what happens when they die. As soon as the brain stops, brain death, at that point you leave the body. And so when a person is actually declared dead, they've already left the body. So you can actually give your organs, to medicine, so they can actually operate on you immediately to take out your heart or your corneas or anything else which they can make use of to help other people. As a Buddhist, you should not be afraid of that. In fact, you're making even better good karma by making your last act of kindness and generosity at your death by being an organ donor. And you're saving lives and creating huge quality of lives for other people. So you can do that straight away. You don't have to wait for 4 hours before they can take your organs, because they can't be used by then. So don't be stupid. I'm an organ donor. So I've got my card in my bag. So now I'm not a hypocrite. I know what happens when I die. And please take all the organs you want from me. Don't need them anymore. So yes, you can go an hour, 5 minutes after you're dead, you can get operated on or whatever. So please don't be superstitious. And you can renovate your home. If the ghost comes, they'll be so pleased that the home doesn't look daggy anymore. So please do it.
Ajahn Brahm, I work as a social worker for the past 8 years. Of late, I feel tired and less patient towards the people whom I've helped or whom I'm helping. How can I help myself so that I can better serve others?
Okay, very good question. In social work, you can get very easily burnt out. First example is when you're a social worker. Ajahn Chah said you should be like a dustbin, because you're taking all people's problems on you. So be a dustbin, so people unload all their rubbish on you. But you must be a dustbin with a hole in the bottom. So they unload their rubbish into you and it goes all the way out. So when you come to your next client, you're totally empty. So that means you don't get full up. Obviously, that social work is so full up with the problems and pain of other people, that's why they're getting negative. So you're carrying too much, you're keeping too much. So you need to do some, especially meditation, where you can actually learn how to let go more of just the last client's problems, so you can be free and empty to receive the next client's problems. So when you go home, you can be free and happy not to be a social worker when you go back home with your family.
Do Buddhists believe in God, with a capital G, and is there an end of the world?
No, the Buddha actually said the end of the world can be found in your own body, the beginning and the end of the world. This is actually one of the stories. There was a monk. And the monk, what happened to him? That's right. He went flying to find the end of the world, the physical end of the world. His name was Rohitasa. He was the first monk in space. True, he levitated. And he went out to try and find the end of the world. And he went on and on and on, couldn't find it, and then he died on the way, obviously. And so when he got reborn, he was really wondering, now where is the end of the world? And so he went to see these gods. And he went to see the first level of gods. And there's many levels of angels. The first level of gods, he said, now where is the end of the world? I tried to find the end of the world. He said, we don't know. Go up to the next level of gods. And went up to the next level of gods. Where's the end of the world? He said, we don't know. This is actually the suttas. And he went up to the highest realm of gods. And he said, where's the end of the world? He said, we don't know. But the great god Brahma, I'm sure he knows. He knows everything. So where is he? So we don't know. But sometimes he comes, sometimes he doesn't come. So the monk waited a while, and he came. He said, I've been waiting for you. Where is the beginning and the end of the world? And this great god Brahma said, I am God, the firstborn, the creator, the originator, the mover, the controller of all that is and has been forevermore. And the monk said, I never asked you that. I asked you, where is the beginning and the end of the world? And God said, I am the great God, the Brahma, the firstborn, the creator, the originator, the powerful. So I never asked you that. You know, where's the Lord? I am God. I'm the creator, the originator. Look, my question was, where's the beginning and end of the world? And God actually took the monk aside and said, shh, I don't know. I don't want these other angels to know that God doesn't know this. He said, monk, you're at fault. You should have gone and asked the Buddha. Now he will know. And so the monk went to see the Buddha, and the Buddha said, monk, the beginning and the end of the world can be found in this fathom-long body. This inside meditation, inside your heart, that's where you find the answer to these questions. And that was a beautiful story. It's an original story taught by the Buddha. And many of the monks know that story. Which is a wonderful story. If you really want to find out, is there a God, is there not a God? Is there an end of the world, a beginning of the world? Where does everything come from? This is where you have to look inside. That's what the Buddha said. This is where all the answers can be found in your meditation, not in belief. Because, okay, I say I don't believe in God. Other people say you're wrong, I believe in God. We just have arguments and wars there. So instead of belief, find out. And this is where you find out. Deep inside, in meditation.
Ajahn Brahm, I read on the internet that you promised in the letter not to ordain any more bhikkhunis without consulting your fellow elders. Is that what you said?
That was about 18 months ago. In those situations, that was my intention at the time. My mistake there was making promises and not giving them a time limit. You know, whenever you actually buy some cheese or some milk, they get best used by, you know, some of 10 days. And that was my mistake, because sometimes you can make promises. I remember having a girlfriend once, and I promised I would love her forever. That was a mistake. And that was 18 months ago. At the time, I meant it. But later on, you know, when I saw what was happening, I thought, well, no, it's a waste of time. And I was consulting them. But I realized it wasn't really going to work. So at the time, I had much more faith and trust in the monks I was dealing with. So this is one of the problems. Please, that was my mistake. Making promises without giving them a use-by date.
I'm in a scenario where my friends want me to go and watch a movie. However, I have a lot of homework to do. Sounds like it's from the youth. If I go out, I won't be able to finish my homework. So what do I do if I don't want to upset my friends?
Easy. Go to the movie and take your homework with you.
Dark in the movie theater.
Oh, you get these little lights on the top of your head, the torch light.
You can answer that one properly. I have to speak for the youth here.
Okay, well, I don't know. You can go to make compromise. Half, go to the movie, and that's what go to the movie, okay,
And put your homework in a bag and just say, oh, I really need to go to the toilet, And if it really is a good movie, they won't notice you've gone. And you go in the toilet and do all your homework in the toilet and just make sure you get back there before the end of the movie. They probably won't even miss you.
Can I give this one a shot?
Okay, well, look.
Just learn to say no. If your friends are upset with you, they're just being very selfish. Find new friends.
Okay.
I'm a mother of a 10-year-old, and I'm constantly in dilemma between looking after my daughter myself instead of putting her in the student care center and building my career. My financial contribution is very important, without which the standard of living will be compromised. How should I make a right choice?
It's always a compromise in life, and you have to make that choice yourself where you think the best compromise is. But really, your standard of living is no more as important as your standard of love. So remember, don't just do these things to show off to your parents or your friends how big your apartment is or how much money you have. What's most important is how much friendship and how much love you have with the people who are really important. So if it was me, I would lean towards having more time with your 10-year-old and less money in the bank. But I was just leaning towards that. But you obviously have to find a balance somewhere, and that's your choice to make that balance.
I'm a cat giver who sterilizes and cares for the community cats in the neighborhood. I do so to prevent unwanted litters and cat culling by the authorities. Because sterilization is unnatural, is this bad karma?
Well,
please explain.
Some people say being a monk is unnatural. But it's good. It's like you're giving the cats 8 precepts so they can't have sex. So actually you're raising the cats up to a higher level so they get a much better birth next time out. It's a wonderful thing you're doing. Well done.
All right, last question.
Okay.
And I'm sorry to those of you that your questions are not answered. There's just too many of them, I'm sorry. And we really should let Ajahn Brahm take his rest soon. Are the teachings of the Dharma existential or deterministic? Is there a free will and agency, or are we at the mercy of extraneous cosmic forces?
Aha. Now that's such a deep question. Is it existential or is it what, deterministic? It's neither. So sometimes when we try and put these categories into the Dharma, these are categories from philosophy. And that philosophy just went in a total different direction than what Dharma does. That goes out into the world in the realm of thinking. So when you come into real Dharma, just the stillness of the mind and feeling these things rather than thinking about them, both of those categories do not really make sense. And even the free will or a cosmic influence, that's very much from the theistic religions, was saying, well, there is suffering, is it God's fault? Because God made the universe. This is according to the theists, the Christians, the Muslims, the Jews, people who believe in God. If he made the universe, then he made cancer. He made lust, which broke up your family. He made sort of dengue fever. So it's him to blame, or her to blame, or whatever. We can't be gender specific these days, because maybe God's a woman? I don't know. But anyhow, because of that, the people who had theistic religions developed the idea of free will, that God gave human beings free will. Therefore, it's not God's fault anymore, it's your fault when things go wrong. And that's where we got, this is very simplified, that's where people got the idea of free will as an excuse for the suffering in this world not being caused by God, because he gave you free will, so you have the choice to do good or do bad. But that's where it came from. Because Buddhism is not a theistic religion, the whole concept of free will or determinism just makes no sense to us. We're in a total different sort of framework to that. So Buddhism is not about that at all. It's totally different to those categories. So what Buddhism is a way of taking responsibility for one's actions and realizing there are consequences to those actions, and those consequences are not sort of imposed upon you by some judge called God. It happens naturally, like laws of nature, not by laws imposed by a being. And also that once we have consequences of our actions, we know that there is a way of doing some kindness, goodness, generosity,
And these are things which do lead to happiness and peace and harmony in our world. And as we go deeper into the peace and harmony, we realize it's the nature of this being we call us. And that's where we find that the more peaceful we come, and being peaceful means actually having no will at all. In other words, being so still that will gets so calm and peaceful that you don't want anything. And that becomes the highest happiness, is to be so content you don't need anything else. Which means you don't need any will. This thing we call will, which is always driving you here and driving you there, just like a wind which blows you backwards and forwards. When that wind, called will, ceases and stops, one has a very, very calm and peaceful day. So it's a totally different philosophy, which is why those categories, they don't fit Buddhism.
Thank you very much, once again, Ajahn Brahm, for the wonderful talk and Q&A.
Thank you.
Well, before you go, I'd like to once again extend an invitation to you to become a member of the Buddhist Fellowship. As you can see, we really try hard to bring the Dhamma to everyone in its form that it's not ritualistic, it's not superstitious in any way, and it's not bound by traditions, but rather living a life that is really beneficial to all and finding love and confidence in ourselves. So we invite you to become a member. And also in the envelopes that you have a form that you can sign up to make a pledge to make a monthly donation so that we can continue to run our center in a professional way. We do have 5 full-time staff, and that is the reason we're able to create so many programs and activities that is of benefit to you and your children in the community. We have a youth camp coming up in December, and we would like to invite you and all your younger relatives to join the youth camp. Please get the information from our staff. And we run weekly programs where we have a youth service every Sunday, including a children's service and a normal service for the adults. We also have meditation courses that we invite you to sign up if you're interested to learn meditation. Next year for Vesak, we will be having a musical, and Lim Kay Siu and Neo Su Lin have already kindly committed to become part of the cast. So any one of you who have talents in singing, in acting, please give us your name so that we can call you in for an audition. So with that, we hope that you will be able to make if you feel that this talk has benefited you, please do make a donation on your way out. That will help us defray the cost of the rental of the hall, as well as advertising the newspaper and all the expenses that we upkeep to run the center every month. So with that, I'd like to thank you very much once again for coming to benefit from Ajahn Brahm's talk. And of course, the big thanks go to the staff and all the volunteers around. Please give a round of applause. And the biggest thank you to Ajahn Brahm. Ajahn Brahm, can we request you to do a short chanting of blessing, and then we will close the evening.
Okay, blessing for you all. Sabaroga vinimuto sabasanta pavajito sabavera mati kando nibuto chatuang bawa Sabitiyo viva chantu sabarogo vinasatu mate bhavan vantarayo sukhiti gayuko bhava apivadanha silitsa nichang vuta pachalino chattaro Dhamma Vatanti Ayuvano Sukhang Balang.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May we dedicate our merits to the cultivation of our mind and to develop a good heart so that we'll be people of great benefit to the community and the world. And may we pray that Ajahn Brahm will be blessed with good health and happiness to continue his path to give lots of teachings around the world and to ordain more bhikkhunis. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Thank you, Ajahn Brahm.
Thank you.